Okay.
No, but I sent you a DM. Noble. Thank you.
Thank you. Ezekiel chapter 20. And it came to pass in the seventh year, in the fifth month, the tenth day of the month, that certain of the elders of Israel came to inquire of Yahweh and sat before me. Then came the word of Yahweh unto me, saying, Son of man, speak unto the elders of Israel and say unto them, Thus saith Yahweh God, are you come to inquire of me? As I live, saith Yahweh God, I will not be inquired of by you. Wilt thou judge them, son of man? Wilt thou judge them? Cause them to know the abominations of their fathers, and say unto them, Thus saith Yahweh God, in the day when I chose Israel and lifted up mine hand unto the seed of the house of Jacob, and made myself known unto them in the land of Egypt, when I lifted up mine hand unto them, saying, I am Yahweh your God. In the day that I lifted up mine hand unto them, to bring them forth of the land of Egypt into a land that I had espied for them, flowing with milk and honey, which is the glory of all lands. Then said I unto them, Cast ye away every man the abominations of his eyes, and defile not yourselves with the idols of Egypt. I am Yahweh your God. But they rebelled against me, and would not hearken unto me. They did not every man cast away the abominations of their eyes, neither did they forsake the idols of Egypt. Then I said, I will pour out my fury upon them to accomplish my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. But I wrought for my name's sake, that it should not be polluted before the heathen among whom they were, in whose sight I made myself known unto them, in bringing them forth out of the land of Egypt. Wherefore I caused them to go forth out of the land of Egypt, and brought them into the wilderness. And I gave them my statutes, and showed them my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. Moreover, also, I gave them my Sabbaths, to be a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am Yahweh that sanctify them. But the house of Israel... Okay, go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, that's a good place to stop. We got this conversation going on about all these alt-right tards or these political tards on Radio Aryan and things like that. And that's a perfect... This opening couple of verses here in Ezekiel perfectly describe people like Grandpa Dan, that they don't have humble or repentant hearts, and they approach the word of God and they can't figure it out. They can't get it. It's not open to them because they don't have repentant hearts. And here it says, you come to inquire of me. And the same thing carries with anybody that examines scripture. If you're a sinner and you don't have a repentant heart, and if you don't seek to love God, then you're not going to understand the Bible ever.
Even Paul had humility. I remember Paul said, I think I have the mind of Christ. He right. was showing humility there.
It wasn't exactly that passage, but yes, I recall where Paul was showing humility. If I myself am worthy, and things like that he did say. Where he said we have the mind of Christ, I don't think he's trying to say that. Okay, that's 1 Corinthians 2:16. For who has known the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. He didn't say I think. Maybe some other New Age version had those words in, Noble. I don't. He said, we have, and it's an indicative verb, meaning that it's just stating a plain fact. But I don't think he meant that himself or the people that he planned on reading this epistle, I don't think he meant that they can think like Christ thinks. I think he meant that we have the mind of Christ as it's presented to us in the Gospels.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean. Maybe I'm imagining it. Okay, I'm going to go back and look. Sorry about that.
But there, that's 1 Corinthians, the end of 1 Corinthians chapter 2. But there are places where Paul was humble in the manner that you stayed. And he had said, if indeed I myself am worthy.
Right.
He wasn't even though Paul of Tarsus is certainly an Israelite and chosen by God, he wasn't so proud as to say, oh, I'm making it. You better watch your own ass or whatever, yeah. Right? You better look out for yourself or something like silly like that that you would hear out of the mouth of a Judeotard today. He was humble and didn't rest assured in his salvation. Let's put it that way.
I'm pretty sure there's a part, though, where he says, now this is not from the prince, but this is from me, though I think I have the mind of Christ, no?
Where he's giving his opinion.
You're talking about 1 Corinthians chapter 7.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, because he says, though I think I have the mind of Christ, am I right? Or maybe I'm remembering wrong.
Isn't that where he doesn't have scripture to give yes, advice? So he gives his own opinion based on, you know, based on scripture. Isn't that that part?
Yes, it is. But I don't. He didn't say, "I think I have the mind of Christ." In
okay,
in that. Let me. I could find that. I think the King James used the word, the phrase "commandment of the Lord," or something like that. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 25. Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord, yet I give my judgment as one that has obtained mercy of the Lord to be faithful. Right? So that's what he said.
Right, okay.
King James Version.
My mind plays tricks on me. In other words,
he's faithful to the scriptures on advice that he can't give a citation from scripture.
Right. Yeah, he does that a lot in Hebrews, but he didn't have his scrolls with him, I guess, when he wrote Hebrews.
He was in prison in Caesarea.
Yeah, Caesarea,
I'm sure he was.
Okay.
But yeah, Paul was humble, right?
Yeah.
He was humble.
Yeah, he was a genius, and he was humble, and I really respect that about him.
User disconnected from your channel.
Well, in verse 12 here, you've got... These Sabbaths were a sign between God and Israel, like the law was a sign between God and Israel. And then it has, but you rebelled against me. They despised his judgment. So that's sort of what you were saying, Bill, about how if you want to know God, you have to come to him with humility and actually tell people his judgments. Because at verse 4 here, you've got cause them to know the abominations of their fathers. So because they had departed from the law, they no longer had a sign that they were the holy people of God, and they despised his judgments.
Well, right. So he wasn't going to let them inquire of him, right? He wasn't going to accept or answer them, except in the negative, where he's condemning them.
I just think it's interesting that the law is a sign between God and Israel. Like this law isn't for everyone. It's not a universal law. It's a particular sign for these people, you know.
Well, right, it's still a sign, even as the Apostle John said in chapter 3, I think, of his, maybe it's chapter 5 of his first epistle, that if you love God, keep his commandments, and if you love your brethren, keep his commandments, and you display the fact that you love your brethren by keeping the commandments of God.
Yeah.
So it's still a sign.
I found the verse which my stupid brain was mixing up. It was 1 Corinthians.
I get confused all the time.
Yeah, I'm an idiot. It was 1 Corinthians 7:40, and I'll read from the CNT. If perhaps then she is happier, so she should remain, according to my opinion. And I think that I also have the spirit of Yahweh. So my brain was messing that up.
That's fine. But yeah, he said, I think.
Yeah.
I'm sure that that's what he said, if that's why I translated it. I'll bet that's dokimazo, I bet that's, I suppose.
Right.
Yes. It's dokeo, which is similar to dokimazo. It's the same stem. It's to think or seem. In English, to think, seem, suppose, imagine, expect. So yes, yeah. That's what he said there.
Yeah, either way, Paul was humble for sure.
Microphone right. Activated.
Yeah, and also if you read the verses above that, 37 to 39, see that it has a double entendre, really speaking of Israel, not necessarily a woman. I mean, it's both.
Yeah, it's sort of witty in a way, what he's saying.
Yeah, because in 39, at the end, you have the only in Yahweh. The end of 39. So she is at liberty to be married to whom she will, only in Yahweh. And that kind of proves to me that it's a double entendre. Right? It means different things.
Okay, but that's a sentence that I punctuated very differently than the King James Version.
See, every time we do these Bible studies, I'm looking at the KJV because I'm trying to, keep it as we're reading it. So I'm sorry, I don't have that handy right now.
That's okay.
How did you put it?
I'm going to look for it. That only in Yahweh belongs to the sentence that follows, as far as I'm concerned. Okay.
Okay, so that's part of verse 47.
Okay, I got it. But if one does consider to be unseemly towards his virgin, if perhaps he is beyond adolescence, and in this way he ought to be, that which he wishes he must do. He does not err, they must marry. But he who has stood firm, steadfast in his heart, not holding forcibly, but who has authority over his own will, and he has decided in his heart to keep himself a virgin, he does well. And therefore, he that is giving himself to a virgin in marriage will do well, but he not giving in marriage will do better. A wife is bound for as long a time as her husband may live, but if perhaps her husband should die, she is free to be married to whom she wishes. Alone in the prince, if perhaps then she is happier. Do you see what I mean?
Okay.
If she's happier staying alone in Christ, right? Though she should remain, according to my opinion, and I think that I also have the spirit of Yahweh. So to me, that's the proper way to punctuate that passage. But it's since verse 40 starts right in the middle of it, it's been misread, as far as I'm concerned, for a long, long time.
Okay, so it's very specific then.
I believe so. Okay. I'll stand by the way I translated that. Like that little kid standing in front of a crowd of people saying, "You're all wrong." I swear they're all wrong. I'm sorry. I'm not trying not to be humble.
Your translation makes sense, Bill.
Thanks. I thought so. We can move on with Ezekiel, I think. I don't know if there's anything else I wanted to talk about. We've had too many digressions, but at least they were Bible study digressions, and we weren't talking about
Taylor Swift
or something.
Well, I think I was on verse 13. But the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They walked not in my statutes, and they despised my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. And my Sabbaths they greatly polluted. Then I said, I will pour out my fury upon them in the wilderness to consume them. But I wrought for my name's sake, that it should not be polluted before the heathen, in whose sight I brought them out. Yet also I lifted up my hand unto them in the wilderness, that I would not bring them into the land which I had given them, flowing with milk and honey, which is the glory of all lands, because they despised my judgments and walked not in my statutes, but polluted my Sabbaths, for their hearts went after their idols. Nevertheless, mine eye spared them from destroying them, neither did I make an end of them in the wilderness. But I said unto their children in the wilderness, walk ye not in the statutes of your fathers, neither observe their judgments, nor defile yourselves with their idols. I am Yahweh your God. Walk in my statutes, and keep my judgments, and do them, and hallow my Sabbaths, and they shall be a sign between me and you, that ye may know that I am Yahweh your God. Notwithstanding the children rebelled against me, they walked not in my statutes, neither kept my judgments to do them, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. They polluted my Sabbaths. Then I said I would pour out my fury upon them to accomplish my anger against them in the wilderness. Nevertheless,
Nevertheless,
I withdrew mine hand and wrought for my name's sake, that I would not be polluted in the sight of the heathen in whose sight I brought them forth. I lifted up mine hand unto them also in the wilderness, that I would scatter them among the heathen and disperse them through the countries, because they had not executed my judgments, but had despised my statutes and had polluted my Sabbaths, and their eyes were after their father's idols. Wherefore I gave them all statutes that were not good, and judgments whereby they would not live. I don't know, it seemed to repeat a few times there, a few parallelisms, but now at verse 25, we have Yahweh saying that he would give them statutes that were not good and judgments that they could not live in. So that seems strange to me that Yahweh would do that.
I think that those statutes that were not good and judge whereby they should not live, I think that's the curses of disobedience and things like that, which are written into the law. I would make that connection. Statutes that were not good and judgments whereby they should not live. The curses of disobedience. When the children of Israel were told to stand upon the two mountains and they uttered the curses from Mount Ebal. I think the other mount was Gerizim. I might be wrong.
Because they had looted. What, sorry?
Oh, I was just saying they found an artifact on one of those mountains just recently.
Yeah, they did, yeah. Was it the oldest etching of Yahweh or something like that?
I'm pretty sure it was.
Yeah.
Yahweh curseth you, cursed you shall die, or something like that.
That's it.
It said you shall surely die.
You shall, yeah, because if Yahweh curses you.
And apparently that blows holes in a lot of different secular ideas on Yahweh.
A lot of different Jewish ideas where the Jews claim, you know, that Yahweh was a made-up desert god or whatever.
That
you know,
a Canaanite god.
All the stuff they make up.
Yep.
It's like the Jews hate the Bible, but it's their book. Doesn't make sense. I don't know.
Bye. Makes no sense at all.
And it's funny that they call themselves Canaanites.
Just pull it apart and undermine it.
They call anything from the Levant Canaanite, and then they end up calling themselves Canaanites. And I don't care how they came to that conclusion. I don't need them to tell me that. God tells me that.
Here in verse 12, I don't know how many people here didn't hear my Genesis 1 commentary. But one of the things I said in that commentary was that Genesis 1 was written in a fashion to provide a basis for the founding of a society. And here, I think this supports my contention over the reason for the 6 days of rest and or the 6 days of work and the seventh day of rest, that Genesis was purposely presented in that manner as to provide us that Sabbath day for the children of Israel later on in the law. And I think that this supports that here in verse 12, where it says that the Sabbath was given to the children of Israel to be a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am Yahweh that sanctifies them. So I think that plays into what I had said in my Genesis 1 commentary, that helps support it.
Yeah, it's not a universal society. It's a godly society that he founded. And this is the sign. This society that God created has his law and his Sabbaths. Yeah. It's not like all the world follows this sign or has this sign.
Right. They do now only because, well, he basically forced it on the world. When the English went out and conquered the whole world and put them on an English schedule, on European calendars and things like that.
Yeah, it's like our order is still standing, even in ways we don't even see.
Right. Right. Chinese never had 7 day weeks or 365 day years. I don't think they ever cared. I think everything that's claimed that the Chinese have now is just communist propaganda. They never had anything. Rice patties and live mice to eat. I think they like live better.
And just until recently in Korea, they couldn't even figure out how old they were because their measurement of the date of your birth was all messed up, that nobody really knew how old the other person was.
That's pretty funny. That is funny.
Yeah, we forget that it's like our society, we're still living in an Adamic world, because outside the Adamic world, they were adding a year to everyone's age on the same date. So they all messed up their ages because on the new year, they'd all just add a year to everyone's age. So everyone had all these weird ages.
So much for the smart Asian.
Well, if you were born in like the year of the rat and there's a year of the rat every 12 years, then in 36 years, you could only be 12 years old.
Yeah, something like that.
They can't count back that far. They can't count back that far.
You'll never have to do military service or anything, really.
I really think that's what that means, Joe, that where it says, I gave them statutes that they should not live. I think that's the curses of disobedience. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
I feel like Yahweh wants the Sabbath to be part of like many elements of his creation. Like we see a Sabbath for the land and everything.
Yes.
So it's sort of not just a sign for Israel, but just like a sign for everything he made.
Well, right. But I think the sign part comes in that the children of Israel are keeping this schedule.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Just like the law, that we keep the law. And that's the only sign we need of who we are, if we keep the commandments and love our brethren.
We probably shouldn't even
Christ requires of us.
We probably shouldn't even hunt animals every 7 years. Like every specific animals. It'd be a hell of a lot of it would be a lot better for them if they had 1 year off where there weren't guys hunting them.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, David. Even though the law doesn't treat it, that is a good point. That probably should be so.
I thought of another interpretation for verse 25, that Yahweh gave them statutes that were not good and judgments whereby they should not live. Well, weren't the rituals of the priests sort of statutes that they had to do, but no matter how perfectly the priest did those rituals, it wasn't the true path to life because a man's never sinless. So could that verse at 25 be sort of prophetic? Could it be referring to the rituals of the priest and how that those rituals they're carrying out don't actually lead to life?
Sort of how Paul says in Galatians, if there was a law giving life, it would have abided until now.
Yeah, I could go with that. I could accept that. That's good. Because the law doesn't really lead to life.
So they didn't really care for God and doing what's right. They only sort of cared for doing the rituals. And so at the end of the kingdom, they're just doing these rituals and going through the motions, and it's not really leading them to life. And they've lost the point of it.
Well, that's true, but the only thing that prevents me from accepting it 100% is because it says, because they had not executed my judgments, but had despised my statutes.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
And the sacrifices were given hand in hand with all the commandments.
Okay, yeah.
But the curses of disobedience were given towards the end of Deuteronomy. It's at the end of the law. In Deuteronomy 28 and 29. And then right after that, we get into the actions of Moses and the Song of Moses and things like that. Okay. There was something else I I had another thought, and Joe, you inspired the thought, but now it's like kind of dead in my brain. I'm sorry.
I was talking about how the signs of a society, of a lawful society, and then I was talking about verse 25 too, the statutes that were not good.
It reminded me of another aspect of my Genesis presentation recently, but I don't have it right now. I just don't have it right now. I'm sorry.
Do you want me to keep reading from 26 then?
Yeah.
And I polluted them in their own gifts, in that they caused to pass through the fire all that openeth the womb, that I might make them desolate, to the end that they might know that I am Yahweh. Therefore, son of man, speak unto the house of Israel, and say unto them, thus saith Yahweh God, yet in this your fathers have blasphemed me, in that they have committed a trespass against me. For when I had brought them into the land for the which I lifted up mine hand to give it to them, then they saw every high hill and all the thick trees, and they offered there their sacrifices, and there they presented the provocation of their offering. There also they made their sweet savour and poured out their drink offerings. Then I said unto them, what is the high place whereunto ye go? And the name thereof is called Bema unto this day. Wherefore, say unto the house of Israel, thus saith Yahweh God, are ye polluted after the manner of your fathers, and commit ye whoredom after their abominations? For when ye offer your gifts, when ye make your sons to pass through the fire, ye pollute yourselves with all your idols, even unto this day. And shall I be inquired of you, O house of Israel? As I live, saith Yahweh God, I will not be inquired of by you. And that which cometh into your mind shall not be at all that ye say, we will be as the heathen, as the families of the countries, to serve wood and stone. As I live, saith Yahweh God, surely with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out will I rule over you. And I will bring you out from the people, and will gather you out of the countries wherein ye are scattered, with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out. And I will bring you into the wilderness of the people, and there I will plead with you face to face, like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so will I plead with you, saith Yahweh God, and I will cause you to pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant.
Face to face, it reminds me of Christ and the reconciliation in Europe.
Absolutely. That face to face, well, through his apostles and
anyone who's seen me has seen the Father.
Yes. Bama does mean high place. The word actually means high place. And for that reason, it was sometimes used of the seats of judges and things like that. But I think Alabama means God of the high place. That's just a quip, but I'm half serious. No. I always thought the name was kind of strange.
Yeah, Alabama. I think it's named after some Cherokee tribe bullshit.
Probably, or Choctaw, or Seminole, or whatever.
Like half the states, I guess. So stupid.
Worst thing we ever did as a people was to leave all those names in place or adopt those names to describe these places. Yeah.
Yep.
I live on the Choctawhatchee River that empties into the Choctawhatchee Bay.
Ruth is just in heaven shaking her fist.
Yes. First thing I want to do is change those names.
It's like their words aren't dying for our mouths.
Nah.
I hate saying their words.
It's even funnier when you get to Louisiana and that they don't pronounce them anything like they look. Like the Chuticabuff River or Natchitoches, which is spelled totally different. It's spelled to look like Natchitoches, but it's Natchitoches.
I really liked what you said, Bill, on your last podcast about how they're demanding that you say Chile and Iran, but yeah, no one says Deutschland or Polska.
Right. It's hypocritical. Isn't that totally hypocritical?
Oh, yeah, totally. No, that was great.
You can't even say Kiev anymore.
I'm really
going off
on a guy on Gab that insisted that I should be saying Iran and Iraq. And I'm like, get the hell out of here, man.
For my entire life, it was always Kiev. And then when this war started, it became Kiev.
Right, yeah.
I mean, everybody here pronounced it Kiev, like in North America. And then all of a sudden, no.
I'm sorry, that's not true. Because I grew up saying Kiev.
Yeah, but you didn't know what the hell you were saying.
That's what I heard in school.
I'm sorry. I just
go to school for 10 years.
Okay, maybe it's a Canada thing, right? Because in Canada, everybody called it Kiev. And then, you know, on American TV, all of a sudden they started saying Kiev. And I was like, wait, I could have sworn that Fox used to call it Kiev.
I wouldn't
doubt
it. I'm
not changing. We have a dish here called Chicken Kiev. I'm not going to start calling it Chicken Kiev. You know, I'm not going to change my whole freaking language.
Well, I'm sure as hell not going to say Iran and Iraq and Chile. Fuck that. It's Chile, Iran, and Iraq. That's how I grew up saying it. That's how I'm always going to say it.
Right. And I'm not going to say Uruguay or whatever the hell you guys say. I'm going to say Uruguay.
We say Uruguay. I grew up saying Uruguay. It's like I'm calling you something bad.
You're gay, right?
Yeah, right. You're a gay.
Did you guys hear they just changed the name of Turkey?
Turkey?
Uranus.
Yeah, well, what is it? What is it?
What is it now? Shithole?
Yeah.
No, really, what are they saying?
Turkey.
If you look like anywhere, like look on Wikipedia, it's like spelled like Turkye or something like that now.
Oh.
Wow.
What the hell? Yeah, you know, in preparation for that podcast last week, right? I was trying to think of what examples I was going to use of European nations. And the first one I thought of was Sweden. So I went on Google Translate and I typed in Sweden, and I knew how they spelled it in Sweden, right? I did, S-V-E-R-G-E. But I hit the pronunciation button and I'm like, no, man, I ain't trying to say that. I ain't doing that. So I moved on to Poland.
Right.
Polska, that's easy.
Yeah,
but go to Google Translate and hit Sweden in English and see how the Swedes say it, and hit the pronunciation button. I just was afraid that I would not be able to properly express that, to properly vociferate that. So I just stayed away from it. It would have been a much better example, but there's no way I was saying that shit. I'm sorry. I just couldn't do it.
But it's very guttural, isn't it?
It is kind of guttural, but it's so weird. It was a female voice first, and the way she was saying Sverg, or however she was saying it, it was really strange. And I'm like, I'm going to screw that up. I ain't going to do that one. Sverg up, maybe, or something like that. Like, maybe I could have done it, but I didn't have confidence in myself. So I did Poland instead, and Germany. Germany is kind of blatant.
You can sound like the chef from the Muppets.
Yeah, I'm not good at voice acting, right? I'm just not. And I suck at pronouncing French and stuff like that. I'm terrible. I know I'm terrible at it.
French is hard.
I'm terrible at English. English is hard enough for me.
Right.
So at verse 37, where it says, I will cause you to pass under the rod, that's the rod of the shepherd, isn't it?
Well, right. I think that means I will cause you to be punished, much the same way that we use it today.
Just like he was punished on the cross, and then we get punished.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've been suffering for our sins for thousands of years. We don't even realize we're being punished.
All right, will I read verse 38, Bill?
Yes, sir.
This is a good one. And I will purge out from among you the rebels and them that transgress against me. I will bring them forth out of the country where they sojourn, and they shall not enter into the land of Israel, and ye shall know that I am Yahweh. As for you, O house of Israel, thus saith Yahweh God, go ye, serve ye every one his idols, and hereafter also, if ye will not hearken unto me, but pollute ye my holy name no more with your gifts and with your idols. For in mine holy mountain, in the mountain of the height of Israel, saith Yahweh God, there shall all the house of Israel, all of them in the land, serve me. There will I accept them, and there will I require your offerings and the first fruits of your oblations and your holy things. I will accept you with your sweet savor when I bring you out from the people and gather you out from the countries wherein you have been scattered, and I will be sanctified in you before the heathen. And ye shall know that I am Yahweh when I shall bring you into the land of Israel, into the country for which I lifted up mine hand to give to your fathers. And there shall ye remember your ways and your doings wherein ye have defiled, and ye shall loathe yourselves in your own sight for all your evils that you have committed. And ye shall know that I am Yahweh when I have wrought with you for my name's sake. Not according to your wicked ways, nor according to your corrupt doings, O ye house of Israel, saith Yahweh God. Moreover, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face toward the south, and drop thy word toward the south, and prophesy against the forest of the south field, and say to the south forest of the south, hear the word of Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh God, behold, I will kindle a fire in thee, and it shall devour every green tree in thee and every dry tree. The flaming flame shall not be quenched, and all faces from the south to the north shall be burned therein. And all flesh shall see that I, Yahweh, have kindled it. It shall not be quenched. Then said I, Ah, Yahweh God, they say of me, doth he not speak parables?
That's a really interesting ending.
I have to admit, yeah, that was interesting.
Well, that pleading in the wilderness, that's very much like Jeremiah chapter 30, chapter 31. Behold, I bring them from the north country and gather them from the coast of the earth, and with them the blind and lame, the woman and the child, and on. And he's telling them to sing with gladness for Jacob and shout among the chief of the nations. Publish ye, praise ye, and say, O Lord, save thy people, the remnant of Israel. And everything points to the captivity of the people in the Babylonian and Assyrian captivities who migrated and spread towards the north, as Isaiah and other prophets say they would. And that pleading in the wilderness, it harkens to Revelation chapter 12, where the woman was fed by the angels in the wilderness. It's amazing how all the prophets interweave with one another all the way through to the Revelation in one extraordinary narrative that's consistent.
Yeah, and then one guy wants to add a very small interpolation at the end of Mark or a very small interpolation in John, and they can't even do that. It fucks everything up.
Right.
They can't even add a small part that is in harmony.
Right. Yeah, it's incredible. That forest of the south is really represents a people.
Yeah, it's another trees or people verse.
Yes, definitely. Who's in the south from where Ezekiel is? And that to me seems to be a prophecy against Edom.
Yeah, especially since in Ezekiel 2, that's when Yahweh says to them, like, come on north and take the vacant land.
Right, we'll get to that in chapter 35.
What is the distinction between every green tree and every dry tree?
Maybe it's in reference to marriage. I don't know. I'll let Bill answer that.
Deadwood.
I think there might be an idiom there that we really don't understand. Even Christ himself had used the idiom.
Yeah, in Matthew. If they do this to the green tree, what will they do to the dry?
Right.
Yeah.
So the green trees might be the trees that are faithful to God. And that's Christ, right? If they do this to the green tree, what would they do to the dry? What would they do to those people that aren't being fruitful for Yahweh? And I think that's also the way it is in Isaiah chapter 56. The Lord has utterly separated me from his people. Neither let the eunuch say, behold, I am a dry tree, a tree without fruit. If that makes sense. I think it does. So the righteous always suffer along with the wicked. The good people always suffer when the bad are punished. And it says that explicitly in Ezekiel.
Yeah, with the sword, right? Where he's like, I'm taking out my sword.
Actually, you
and
know
shall
what?
Slay the wicked and the just.
Cut off the wicked and the just, right.
I think that Revelation 9:4 supports your what you just said, Bill. It was commanded unto them, commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads.
Right. The dry trees. That this that righteous and the wicked is in the next chapter, right? It's in chapter 21. So right, David, that probably does support what I just said. I'm sure it does. So the men that have not the seal of God upon their foreheads would be dry trees. We commence with chapter 21 if y'all want.
Yeah, I was just checking the dry tree thing for a sec. All right. Chapter 21. Then this message came to me from Yahweh. Son of man, turn and face Jerusalem and prophesy against Israel and her sanctuaries. Tell her, this is what Yahweh says. I am your enemy, O Israel, and I am about to unsheath my sword to destroy your people, the righteous and the wicked alike. Yes, I will cut off. I'm reading from the NLT. Just
wait one second.
I thought that sounded a bit dumbed down, eh?
Yeah, I was like, this is not what I'm reading.
And say to the land of Israel, thus saith Yahweh, behold, I am against thee, and I will draw forth my sword out of his sheath, and will cut off from thee the righteous and the wicked. Seeing then that I will cut off from thee the righteous and the wicked, therefore shall my sword go forth out of the sheath against all flesh from the south to the north, that all flesh may know that I am Yahweh. I, the Lord, have drawn forth my sword out of his sheath. It shall not return any more. Sigh, therefore, thou son of man, with the breaking of thy loins and with bitterness sigh before their eyes. And it shall be, when they say unto thee, wherefore sightest thou, that thou shalt answer, for the tidings, because it cometh, and every heart shall melt, and all hands shall be feeble, and every spirit shall faint, and all knees shall be weak as water. Behold, it cometh, and shall be brought to pass, saith Yahweh God. Again, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, prophesy, and say, thus saith Yahweh, say, a sword is sharpened and also furbished. It is sharpened to make a sore slaughter. It is furbished that it may glitter. Should we then make mirth? It contemneth the rod of my son as every tree. And he hath given it to be furbished that it may be handled. This sword is sharpened and it is furbished to give it into the hand of the slayer. Cry and howl, son of man, for it shall be upon my people. It shall be upon the princes of Israel. Terrors by reason of the sword shall be upon my people. Smite therefore upon thy thigh.
So this might be cross-reference to Romans chapter 13, where we see that tyrannical governments are basically a punishment from God that are meant to punish the wicked. But here in Ezekiel, we'll see that the righteous are also cut off along with the wicked.
What does furbish mean? Is that an old way to say furnish?
Yes.
All right.
Furbished, like manufactured.
Right.
They want to define it as polished, scoured, polished, smooth, the Hebrew word. I'm going to go marat, M-R-T. See if I can find that. To make smooth or bare, to scald, scour, or polish. That's not how I would define furbish. Excuse me. To scour or polish a sword. Okay, let's see what furbished means according to the dictionary, because I always thought, like, refurbish, right?
Right, yeah.
Sort of like restore something or remanufacture it almost.
Right.
To give a fresh look is how they define furbish, which surprises me. It's never... Huh. It's not how I ever thought of the term. But they also add to renovate, which is to rebuild something. It's a little deeper than just
right,
in my opinion.
To make bold is one definition. So to like take your sword out of its sheath and bare it is a meaning of furbish. That's what I thought. That's sort of how I saw it.
Yeah, well, here they give an archaic, this is Oxford Languages, that's what Google usually uses. An archaic definition is to brighten up a weapon by polishing it. So that surprises me, but there you have it. I always thought renovate is the closest that I ever got to the meaning of the word.
Yeah, but it does sound really nice in 10 because it's saying that it glitters, so it's kind of like almost like reborn.
Yes.
And do you think the righteous have been slayed with the wicked because the righteous didn't call out the sins of the wicked? So they're not really that righteous?
Well,
it's
well,
like
that
David.
Is right. And they were criticized for that back in Ezekiel chapter 9, I believe. But there were still men that were given a mark by God that were good men that were to assist in the judgment against Jerusalem. If you recall Ezekiel chapter 9.
The men who were vexed.
Yes. The men that were vexed by the sins that were going on around them. So, right, being good isn't good enough to not be judged by God. You actually have to resist evil. You have to resist it. You have to be vexed by the sin around you.
Right.
Paul said something like, I only wish I do not do evil, because to hope to do good was too much for him. Didn't he say something like that? Like, I only wish not to do evil.
That was speaking about sin in relation to the law and Romans chapter 7, maybe chapter 6 or 6 and 7. Of course, you can never figure out. I could never figure out how the King James phrases something. Okay, Romans chapter 7, verse 19.
Oh, sorry, Will. I didn't think you'd bring it up, but I just was thinking of that, like no man, not even Paul, was hoping to be a righteous man, so...
Yeah, I brought it up in Bible Works by typing, not do evil. For the good that I would, I do not. In other words, the good that I desire to do, I do not. But the evil which I would not, the evil which I do not desire to do, that I do. I don't think Paul's really saying that he does all these horrible things. He's just describing the inevitability of sin. It's inevitable that we're going to sin.
Even if we don't want to, and if we suffer that, it tears at us.
Right. It does tear at us, and that's what Paul was explaining, that it tears at him. Now, if I do that, I would not. It is no more... I didn't do it, but the sin that dwelleth in me. Because he doesn't want to do it, but he does it. That sounds nuts, but... I guess we catch ourselves doing stupid things all the time. And it's like, what the fuck are you doing? And snap yourself out of that. that line of thought, or because he's speaking mostly about thoughts.
Oh, is he? Okay.
I believe he's speaking mostly here about thoughts.
Well, thoughts, they give birth to error, as James put it. So you better stamp out those thoughts quick.
Right. So if he does it, it's he doesn't want to do it, and that's the sin that dwells in him that's compelling him to do it against his own wishes. I think he's using himself as an example, but I don't think Paul was that much of a sinner. He's just being humble once again by using himself as an example.
I think it'll be an amazing thing when this corruptibility puts on incorruptibility, as Paul put it, and we don't suffer temptation anymore. That's going to be so nice.
I don't know if it's that we're not going to suffer any temptation anymore.
Or we'll just be forced to be obedient. I don't know. I don't know the divide.
Right.
Well, yeah, it'll just be nice to live in that world, you know?
Yes, absolutely. I agree. I don't know. I hate leaving the house because all we do when we leave the house is sit around town and have a beer here or dinner there or drive up and down this road or that and bitch about everything that we see. The race mixers, the faggots, it never ends.
The vexation never ends.
There's like really nothing good left except our brethren and nature. Maybe music.
Right, but we have to drive through 10 tons of bullshit sometimes just to get to nature, right?
Right.
Unless we sit here in our backyard and just look at the canal all day. That's a possibility.
Yeah, but it's like anything. If you dwell upon all the bad things, then you know it just kind of accentuates itself. Like you continue to do so. Because there are little conversations and gestures that white people make to each other on a daily basis that I try to concentrate on because it is really nice. It may only be like 10 seconds. So I can have a conversation with a white person in a store or wherever. Really enjoy it, you know?
Yeah, and those small interactions, even if they're small, it's still like brotherly love. Even if the person you're talking to doesn't really see it that way, it's still brotherly love.
Yeah, and you can see the difference between the way we interact with one another and then the way we interact, the way other races interact between each other. It's always fake, right? It seems fake.
Oh, yeah.
And
I agree.
And then when we interact with them, then we're faking it, you know?
Right.
All right, you want me to continue?
Yeah, there's something interesting here in verse 10 that I was looking at, speaking about that sword. And I'm going to read the NAS. Sharpened to make a slaughter, polished to flash like lightning, or shall we rejoice? The rod of my son despising every tree. That almost could be a double entendre. The rod of Jacob being Yahweh's son, or the rod of Christ.
The rod of my son despising every tree.
Is that when all the bad trees are cut up?
Or it could be like he's dividing. He's dividing the planet between the good tree and the bad tree.
Right, yeah.
The tares and the wheat. he contemn, he despise every tree. So it's like he's judging every tree. That's how I saw it.
Yeah, that's an interesting passage.
Yeah, that's good. In the NASB, it's better than in the King James because of that.
Yes.
They don't even have that word in the King James. I wonder why.
What word?
Despising.
Contemneth.
Oh, okay. I'm missing it. All right, never mind.
Well, I don't blame you for missing it. It's a pretty archaic word used in a pretty archaic manner. Okay, let's look up contemn.
Yeah. Well, I guess contempt.
Yes, to treat with regard or contempt.
I don't know if we even have the word contemn anymore. We only have contempt. That's why when I was reading it, I was like, what? Contemneth.
Yeah, it's an archaic word. It's the active form of it's an active form of a verb though, right? To hold in contempt is to contemn. It could say, if you wanted to reword it from and neglect the grammar of the original, it could probably say, as every tree holds the rod of my son in contempt, right?
Hmm.
The rule of his son. So it's like the trees despise the rule of his son, of Yahweh's son. Which trees? Which trees despise his rule? It kind of makes me think of Luke. You know, who would not have me rule over them? Bring them hither and slay them before me?
Right.
Some despise his rule.
An interesting commentary one day, if I get around to it in about 15 years. No, I'm kidding. Maybe five.
Yeah, I don't know how anybody could look at their maker and not be obedient unless it's not their maker.
Right. Every knee shall bow. That means every Adamic knee or every Israelite knee. In the context in which it was first uttered.
Well, in Revelation, doesn't it?
It's every knee was, every Israelite knee shall bow, right? Because it was in reference to the 7,000 men that had not bent a knee to bow. You were saying?
In Revelation, when it says they gather to make war with the Lamb and the Lamb overcomes them, and that's after the second advent. Is that sort of like showing us that when Christ returns, they're going to try to kill him? Like in some final desperate move? Or is it more so his people? Trying to kill his people. And because they're trying to kill his people, they're doing it to him too.
And what passage is this? Am I missing this? I'm sorry.
Revelation 19, I think, if I remember correctly.
Well, yeah, the dragon makes war with Christ, and yeah, I mean, he's making war now with Christ.
Right, right.
But I don't think that's going to stop if Christ returns.
Yeah, because Joe mentioning how here of the rod and the tree and how they hate his rule, it just made me think of that verse in Revelation, like he's coming back to set up his kingdom, and they're like, oh, we got to stop this, you know.
Well, I mean, they are that arrogant.
Yeah, like I literally think they would try to kill him a second time and they would just, of course, get completely obliterated by God.
They really are that arrogant. I could see him pulling the nuclear option.
Yeah, they would probably try to nuke Christ. Yeah.
To stop their fate.
Well, if they're godless, you know, what would stop them? They're that arrogant because they're godless.
Well, they refused to recognize or to acknowledge that he was from God the first time. And then, of course, they're going to do that a second time. Why would they change their modus operandi now?
Yeah, and they drink their own Kool-Aid. That they actually think that the weapons they create are powerful.
Right.
Right.
I agree.
It's humanism, you know, to a great extent.
Yeah, one earthquake can do much more damage than any of their weapons. One volcano.
Yeah.
They'll surround him like bees, and he'll quench them like the fire of thorns.
One good hurricane.
Or one just good
hurricane wiped out Tyndall Air Force Base.
Or wiped just a word out of his mouth, as Paul puts it in 2 Thessalonians.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like there are verses that seem to say that the wicked just disappear in a second, in the blink of an eye. They're just gone, and we go out, look at where have they gone? They're not here. As if waking from a dream. I think there's a psalm or a proverb like that. As if waking from a dream, the wicked have all vanished. And that's the power of God. His will can just snap into existence. He doesn't need some little, like, anything to happen. They can just disappear as in a dream, or like an old piece of clothing. They just fall away as if eaten by moths. They just fall away. They're banished like darkness before the light.
Praise Yahweh for that.
There are verses like that. They're some of the most profound verses. I look for ones like that, the poetic and the profound.
Oh, I love them.
Hey, Bill, you want me to read from verse 14?
Yeah, we can finish this chapter.
Thou, therefore, son of man, prophesy and smite thine hands together, and let the sword be doubled the third time. The sword of the slain, it is the sword of the great men that are slain, which entereth into their privy chambers. I have set the point of the sword against all their gates, that their heart may faint and their ruins be multiplied. Ah, it is made bright. It is wrapped up for the slaughter. Go thee one way or other, either on the right hand or on the left, whithersoever thy face is set. I will also smite mine hands together, and I will cause my fury to rest. I, Yahweh, have said it. The word of Yahweh came unto me again, saying, also thou, son of man, appoint thee two ways, and the sword of the king of Babylon may come. Both twain shall come forth and out of one land, and choose thou a place. Choose it at the head of the way to the city. Appoint a way that the sword may come to Rabbath of the Ammonites, and to Judah in Jerusalem, the defensed. For the king of Babylon stood at the parting of the way, at the head of the two ways, to use divination. He made his arrows bright. He consulted with images. He looked in the liver. At his right hand was the divination for Jerusalem, to appoint captains, to open the mouth in the slaughter, to lift the voice with shouting, to appoint battering rams against the gates, to cast a mount and to build a fort. And it shall be unto them as a false divination in their sight, to them that have sworn oaths. But he will call to remembrance the iniquity, that they may be taken. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh God, because ye have made your iniquity to be remembered, in that your transgressions are discovered, so that in your doings your sins do appear, because I say that ye are come to the remembrance, ye shall be taken with the hand. And thou, profane, wicked prince of Israel, whose day is come, when iniquity shall have an end, Thus saith Yahweh God, remove the diadem and take off the crown. This shall not be the same. Exalt him that is low and abase him that is high. I will overturn it, and it shall be no more until he come whose right it is, and I will give it to him. And thou, son of man, prophesy and say, thus saith Yahweh God concerning the Ammonites and concerning their reproach. Even say thou, the sword is drawn for the slaughter, it is furbished to consume because of the glittering. While they see vanity unto thee, whilst they divine a lie unto thee, to bring thee upon the necks of them that are slain of the wicked, whose day is come when their iniquity shall have an end. Shall I cause it to return into his sheath? I will judge thee in the place where thou wast created, in the land of thy nativity. And I will pour out mine indignation upon thee. I will blow against thee in the fire of my wrath, and deliver thee into the hand of brutish men and skillful to destroy. Thou shalt be for fuel to the fire. Thy blood shall be in the midst of the land. Thou shalt be no more remembered, for I, Yahweh, have spoken it. End of chapter 21.
First, just to sate my own curiosity, as we read this chapter, I was wondering how I didn't cite this chapter in reference to Romans chapter 13 commentary, which was like, it was 8.5 years ago. I don't believe it was 8.5 years ago, but it does. It's been 8.5 years since I did my Romans commentary. It seems like just like a couple of years or less, right? It's incredible how time speeds by. But I just want to say that I did cite Ezekiel chapter 21 for a paragraph and a half. So I talked about it, and then I cited verses 1 through 5 in relation to Romans 13. So I was kind of like glad, I was happy that I saw that, right? Because it's like, how could I miss this if I'm doing a Romans 13 commentary? Because it's the same exact theme, as far as I'm concerned. In verse 27, I will overturn it. That's the verse that the British Israel people try to claim proves that the English should rule the world, right? That that's where David's throne is in London because of these three overturns. And they try to say that it went from Jeremiah in Egypt to Ireland to Scotland to England in reference to this throne of David. That's what they claim. It's all bullshit. I don't agree with any of it. And where it says, until he comes, who's right it is, I believe that's speaking of Christ. It's not speaking of British Israel or Queen Elizabeth at all. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I know about that three overturns, but I'm not even sure if that's a specific thing, like it's supposed to be three overturns to even tell you something.
Right, it just says it's going to be overturned again and again. That's how I read that. The English throne has been overturned many times.
Would the Hasmonean dynasty would that have been an overturn?
Well, I just think that power is going to be removed from the king of Judah, and it's going to fall into many different hands until the coming of Christ. So we had the Babylonians, and then we had the Persians, and then we had Alexander the Great, and in his passing, Judea went back and forth a couple of times between being controlled by the Ptolemies and being controlled by the Seleucids. So there's several overturns right there.
So it's not specifically Judah, it's more who has hegemony over the world?
Well, it's speaking about the profane, wicked prince of Israel. And remove the diadem and take off the crown seems to be speaking in reference to Zedekiah, because at this time he's the only one wearing such a crown, right?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. We even saw him mentioned earlier that he wouldn't see Babylon.
Right.
What was your question again, Noble? You said, was something an overturn?
I was wondering if the Hasmonean dynasty was one of the overturns.
Well, it would have been because they were one of the parties in control of Judea for some time, right?
Right.
But you had the Babylonians. I'm sorry, Joe. Let me just enumerate this real quick.
Right. That's right.
Babylonians, and then you had the Persians, and then you had Alexander the Great, and the Hellenistic governors of the Seleucids and Ptolemies who were fighting over Judea at one point, fighting over control of the Levant at one point. And then you had the Hasmoneans, and then you had the Romans. So it was overturned a half dozen times before the coming of Christ.
Yeah, so to make British Israelism work, you've basically just got to pick a few of those times and say, oh, those were the official times. They're more significant than those other times. There were only three, see? We were right. You know, so like what Noble's trying to do, like say, which ones are the official three overturns? And then it's like you can't say because it's a British Israel concept. You right. know, like they invented the concept so they could define which are the three official overturns. And like Bill's pointing out, how could they possibly do that? It's part of their little doctrine that right. doesn't make sense.
It's a doctrine they had to justify their belief that Queen Elizabeth was flawless and sat on David's throne and England was to rule the world. And they really made that up about Victoria. That was in the days of Victoria that legitimized the English Empire. All their doctrines were geared towards legitimizing the English Empire. And when the English Empire fell apart, they're fools. They're just laughingstocks.
I would have trouble accepting a female as like one of the official overturns, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because I'm a bad man.
Yeah, but it started with a female with Tia Tefi.
Oh, that's where they started. So that's the first official.
Yeah. The first overturn is they claim, I don't buy this, that David's throne was transferred in the person of the king's daughters from Palestine through Egypt to Ireland. And that's the first overturn. And then to Scotland is the second overturn. And then to England with James V of Scotland, and he became the king of England. And that's the third overturn. But then they conveniently ignore Cromwell.
Yeah, it makes so much more sense that every overturn is, I guess, basically a beast empire. And then the final overturn is Esau rising up his sword against his brother. And then after that, it goes to who it belongs, and that's Christ.
Yeah, but you're still getting hooked into this idea of an official overturn, though. Well, that's what I'm saying is like a British Israel concept.
Right. Well, not really.
Overturn. It simply means that power is going to be transferred constantly to other parties until he comes whose right it is.
Okay, I'm sort of stuck in that line of thinking, but I see what you guys mean now.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say to you, is you're getting stuck in their little trick doctrine.
Okay, Noble, let's say you're my son, and I tell you, if you do this, you're going to get fucked again and again and again. Does that mean that you're only going to get screwed over three times?
Right. I see what you mean, Bill. Yeah.
Or does it mean that because you took a certain path in life that you're just going to get screwed over again and again and again and maybe again and again and again and again, again? But I just say again and again and again to make a point. And that's all this is here.
Not because it's an official Bible doctrine and an or like a truth from God that comes directly from right. God. There's going to be three overturns. I've got that straight from Yahweh.
Right. It's a saying. It's a figure of speech. It's not making an exacting prophecy that there would be exactly three overturns.
Gotcha. I got you guys. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I knew you had it a lot early on. I just thought I'd explain it a bit more. Just to bash on the, you know, the CI light British Israels.
And
they're the stories they made up about scriptures and especially the prophets are just horrible.
This is sort of on the same topic, Bill, but Nebuchadnezzar, do we know where he was from when he was ruling Babylon?
Yeah, you know, there's very little known about the personal lives of any of those figures. I do believe they have a little on Nebuchadnezzar. And he's definitely a Chaldean. I don't know if I think they know who his father was and things like that.
Yeah,
I don't think they.
I couldn't find very much information when I was looking.
Because there's not very much information.
I was like, I'm pretty sure it's a white guy.
Yeah, they argued for so long that he didn't even exist until they dug up stuff out of the ground proving he existed.
Well, that's the Jews always trying to deconstruct society by knocking the pillars out from under it.
Yep.
Yeah, everything's a myth to them. They try and mythologize everything. Like, oh, those are just the quaint little beliefs of those weird... You know, they try and frame everything the white race believes as just being little myths and stuff that they just believe for no reason. Even our belief in God would be like a little superstition to them because they themselves are godless. So they could not understand why we believe in God or anything. So I think that's why they're deconstructionists, is because they're godless.
Yeah, they know who Nebuchadnezzar's father was, Nabopolassar, but they don't know, they're not really sure who his grandfather was.
Yeah.
He's not a superstar like Solomon.
And they don't even know, at least what I was looking at, they didn't even know what his father's nationality was.
How many wives did he have? Did he spend any time partying? You know, we don't know any of this.
Everyone had a different claim where it was like one was an Egyptian, one was Assyrian, one was a Chaldean.
I'll bet none of the guesses were Canaanite.
No, I don't think so.
That's funny. Because then the Book of Desert would have been a Jew. Even by admission of the Jews. He was probably a Chaldean. Nabu was their god. I don't think Nabu was an Akkadian god. I mean, I could be wrong. Don't get me wrong.
What's all this talk about Canaanites? Don't you guys know that they disappeared off the face of the earth?
And they were white?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess Nabu was worshipped by the Assyrians too.
Was it sort of like the Greeks and the Romans, how they shared many deities? Did the Assyrians and Babylonians share deities?
Yeah, they did, but a lot of those deities were tribal, but a lot of them were general, and the Sumerians and the Babylonians and the Assyrians all shared a whole host of these gods and goddesses in common, and perpetuated the Akkadians and the Babylonians both perpetuated many of the ancient legends of the Sumerians, including the legend of Gilgamesh.
Right.
They may have differed on their creation myths and things like that, but even they were very similar in a lot of ways.
And those Sumerian myths, a lot of those were from like beasts. Sumeria, wasn't it like very mixed society?
Well, yeah, there were Canaanites and Assyrians. There were the Shemites, the Hamites, and the Canaanites all together. The Rephaim, the Kenites, just throw in a blender.
Hey, if you Google who are the Canaanites today, it says that they're the present-day Lebanese population.
Well, I guess they're not wrong, but it goes much bigger than that.
Yes.
The Palestinians like to claim they're Canaanites.
It also includes Louis Miguel, or however you say his name.
Yes, it does. Definitely. I'm still waiting for Free Florida to put up that spick video.
I'm sure it was the most I'm sure it was like the most profound speech ever. It was likely Hitler level charisma. I'm sure it was mind blowing.
I'm sure, right. And at the end, they shared Cuban sandwiches and flan for dessert.
Well, if the church teaches, like, I don't know if David was joking or not, but if the church does teach that Canaanites are extinct, like, that really goes against the last part of Zechariah, doesn't it? In that day, there will be no Canaanite in the house of Yahweh. And I think that prophecy is clearly, if you read the context of the chapter, not fulfilled. So if they say that, it's sort of like cognitive dissonance.
Well, it is just like they say the children of Israel are extinct. They were taken into Assyrian captivity. They consider blended in with everybody else to be extinct. If they can't identify them historically, then they must be extinct. People don't disappear that easy. Matthew called the woman a Canaanite. He wasn't joking.
Right. And then they'll be like, oh, Mark calls her a Syro-Phoenician. But I understand that Mark had a different audience. They didn't know what a Canaanite was.
Right. So Matthew identified her by her Old Testament race, and Mark identified her by the Roman culture of the time, the Roman cultural terms. Because you don't find the word Canaanite in any Greek or Roman literature anywhere outside of the New Testament.
Yeah, don't they like pretty much call everyone in Palestine Syrians for the most part?
Right, Syrians or Phoenicians, but the Romans call them all Syrians.
Yeah.
Because the Phoenicians were extinct. Kidding. Mark called the woman a Syro-Phoenician, but the word Phoenician had fallen into disuse, probably after the Punic Wars. But Syria and Tyre, or Taurus, that they come from the same word. Both of those names come from the same word, the same Hebrew word, T-S-O-R, Tsor.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And Taurus became the name of the city, and Soros became the name of the land around the city. And the land that the Phoenicians had controlled on the coast. Because Tyre was the preeminent city. So Syria and Tyria, or Tyre, or Taurus. In Greek and Latin, it's Taurus and Soros. Okay, and both of those words are the same Hebrew word, T-S-O-R. One, they drop the S, and the other, they drop the T, and they put a Greek ending on it. For real.
So it's sort of like Tsar, like the Russian title for nobility? Phonetically?
Yes, T-S-O-R. It's actually a Hebrew letter.
Okay.
That is represented by a TS in English and other languages. And that letter is sometimes transliterated as a Z. That's why we have Sidon and Zidon, and it's the same place, right? But it's not really properly a Z, and the Hebrews had another letter that was a Z. But tier is T-S-R. That's how it's spelled in Hebrew. The T-S sound letter, and the, which is the tsadi, and the resh, or the R. Two letters.
But what you're referring to, Noble, is Tsar is the way they said Caesar. It's the Roman
fashion.
Pardon?
Like Caesar?
Yeah.
Okay.
And even that has two spellings, right? T-S-A-R and C-Z-A-R.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess we can stop recording there, David.
Okay.